Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature poet Nikki Finney from a 2013 Portland Arts and Lectures event. Nikki Finney formally began her career as a poet 35 years ago with her first collection, On Wings Made of Gauze. Since then, she's published 7 collections and has had an illustrious career as an educator. In 2011, Nikki Finney won the National Book Award for Poetry for her collection, Head Off and Split. When she took the podium at the Black Tie Ceremony, in addition to thanking her colleagues and loved ones, she delivered a speech, now considered legendary, which opens with these sentences. Quote, "We begin with history, the slave codes of South Carolina, 1739. A fine of $100 and 6 months in prison will be imposed on anyone found teaching a slave to read or write. And death is the penalty for circulating any incendiary literature." Not only did the speech go viral on social media, but it was included in the inaugural exhibit of the African American Museum of History and Culture in Washington, D.C. And to me, it exemplifies how profound it is to hear Finney speak and read. No opportunity is treated lightly. Every word is chosen, every phrase full of meanings, and every subject connected to the vast workings of history, family, belief, and language. Listening to Finney in this episode, it's nearly impossible to tell from when she is talking and from when she is reading her poetry. She begins with her 99-year-old grandmother and takes us on a kind of autobiographical tour with her work. It's by turns solemn, hilarious, tender, and heartbreaking. Here's Finney.
Thank you so much. Good evening, Portland. Wild, imaginative, irreverent Portland. Have I come to the right place? Excellent. I've come tonight to tell you what my grandmother taught me a long, long time ago. But I'd like to start with a quote. "A woman has to be a daughter before she can be any kind of a woman. If she doesn't have that in mind, if she doesn't know how to relate to her ancestors, to her tribe, she's not good for much." Toni Morrison. My grandmother is the very reason I have become the very poet you are about to spend some time with this evening. Born in 1900, she taught me that telling a lie was something akin to murder. No small thing. She also taught me to look whoever I was talking to directly in the eye. So my plan tonight is to look all 1,500, 1,700, 2,000 plus of you in the eye and in the heart tonight. She also taught me that it was human and right to be afraid sometimes, but she went on to let me know that she would not claim me as her granddaughter if I ever refused to not walk into that fear with everything she had taught me about truth and honesty and goodness. I wanted very much for this great farming woman with no claim to fame to claim me. Chapter 1. My grandmother is here visiting. This morning, while she was still asleep on her back, I crept up close and counted them all again. I've been studying Beulah Davenport's chin hairs for years now, hoping to know something about her powers. She has 19 chin hairs, which are sometimes here and sometimes not. I stand in the doorway, watching her in the bathroom mirror, surrounded by Pop Leo's things, his razor and cup always on the side of the face bowl. Eventually, she will smooth pearl-white lather down around her chin. Suddenly, she is a tiny black woman Santa, a caramel-colored I Love Lucy in classic pose. I like to watch as her 99-year-old hands move sideways across and under the belly of her barely wrinkled face. She does not see me leaning into the door, wishing she wouldn't shave away her golden chin straw. This is my research material, I want to scream. She does not know that I believe these hairs hold the key to all her powers. She never sees me counting, pulling on the tiny hairs beneath my own chin, wondering, when can I count on being just like her? Chapter 2. This morning at breakfast, we had an argument about putting the cans and bottles into the recycle bin instead of the trash can. She refuses to do it. I keep going behind her, retrieving the shiny, see-through things from the garbage. Yesterday, she told me that only white folks save bottles and cans. She says black folks save the earth just by getting up in the morning. Yes, ma'am, I answered. I tell her I want to buy her something new for her 100th birthday. I ask her, will she go to the mall with me to help me find it? She cuts off my sentence as soon as she hears the word mall. She says in her most amazed voice that she just heard on the radio that it's Senior Citizens Day at the Salvation Army thrift store. She says, can you believe it? Everything with a blue tag is 50% off. Already she is reaching for her pocketbook and slipping it on her arm and handing me my keys that I do not remember asking her for. 2. I am sitting at a $4 desk at the Southside Salvation Army thrift store, biding my time by writing poetry. Every now and then I look up from my writing to find my grandmother teetering down a row of color-coordinated clothes. She is moving like an old loggerhead trying to decide where best to lay her eggs. She is holding on to her walker, which along with her hearing aid, she hates to use in public. At the same time, she is pushing a rickety shopping cart. I don't know how she's doing both these things at the same time. Every time I ask her, does she need my help? She sucks her teeth real loud and moves on up the aisle away from me, blues singing something about, don't treat me like I'm old. Treat me like I can be recycled, remember? 3. She is up in aisle 7, carefully putting $2 and $3 dresses into her push basket. Some of them I can see are expensive tweed and gabardine suits that I imagine rich ladies gained weight and outgrew. Some of them I imagine those same rich ladies might have worn up until their last day on earth. I imagine their children have brought these and other of their things here to the Salvation Army thrift store, no longer able to set a watery eye on them. My grandmother is pulling out the most expensive things. When she holds them up for her inspection, looking for moth bites or broken zippers, I tell myself that I can see the outlines of the bodies of the women who once owned them still in them. This is the poem I want to write. Chapter 3, The Bra. My grandmother is 4'11" and some change. Her 99-year-old body is a small work of art to me. Her Vaseline massage skin is only now just starting to sag. She has never had much for hips. Her breasts are small, but still fierce in their own way. More and more, her back is bending in like a tiny mountain giving way to that pounding sea called old age. I am 5'11¼". Everywhere she is small boned, I am big boned. She is maybe 100 pounds if you pour 2 oceans in her pockets. This morning is the last full day of her visit, and this morning I could not find my sports workout bra. The comfortable one with the no underwire that doesn't poke me out like Miss Perfect Body in the Victoria's Secret commercial. I am here with her at the Salvation Army thrift store again. This is our third straight day of shopping. We have been here for 5 hours already with no lunch bell in sight. She knows she's leaving tomorrow, and so unlike all the other days, she's stopping everybody in every aisle, talking to them as if she will never see them again. She's acting like all weekend she has been attending some grand convention of little old lady Salvation Army shoppers, and today will be the closing festivities. She is treating the clothes unusually bad, stepping on them, throwing them over the dusty splintered top of the door. I have been following behind her like a human vacuum cleaner. Occasionally, she wobbles up to the front counter in between trying things on, breaking in line ahead of others to remind the cashier that it is criminal to ask $2 for a wool suit. The people who work here have begun to smile at me. Some even make it a point to touch me on the shoulder when we pass in the aisle. One even whispered yesterday, "I could never do what you are doing." Today, somebody passed by as I sat back down at my poetry table. "I could never have the kind of patience that you have," she said. I smiled back, too polite to say what I want to say, which is, "But this is my grandmother. And I am 42 years old, and she is 99, and we are here on earth at the same time. And I am all of who I am because she made me fried corn and cabbage every summer day that I lived with her as a child. And every time I entered her house as a girl, there were homemade whole wheat breadsticks and apple fritters cooling on the side of the stove. There was blackberry juice waiting in mason jars that had already been tendered with the natural sugary spoons of her hands. I want to say, if you could still look up in the world and see yourself in the eyes of the one who is the very reason you are graciously still free of madness, then you would do whatever you had to do for her. Four. There are only two tiny dressing rooms. There are people waiting in a line to use them. There are lots of people waiting in line. My grandmother has made one of them her home away from home. Her movements are pretty slow. It takes her a long time to pull each dress down around her. My job is to return anything she does not want to the racks. She does not allow me to help her undress or dress. I reach to tap on the left side door because walking towards it, I notice 100 dresses on the floor. I hear my grandmother shouting through the door at the line of people, telling them to be nice. In Jesus' name, she says, be nice. She even counsels them through the door that they might consider leaving and trying the other Salvation Army thrift store on the west side of town if they are in such a hurry. I have no idea how she knows about the other store. I pop my head inside dressing room number one. She is there with a jungle of tops and bottoms and a sea of chiffon all around her feet. Just as I'm about to take an armload of clothes back outside past the mob of waiters, I look at her and there is my lost sports bra. It is double wrapped around her small upper body like a body bandage. It's twisted and looped all around her like a bad seat belt that has been in several accidents. Somehow, it is holding everything on her in. Womanly, tight, youthful. I start laughing at the clothes, start falling, and she starts swatting me with a blue seersucker jumper. Something must be mighty funny for you to leave the door open so long. I stop laughing long enough to point to her upper body. She finally looks down at herself. She pokes up real close to the looking glass, straightens out her trifocals, leaning even closer to the mirror, it all comes into focus. Lord, baby, that's why everything fitting me so good today. I've come now to the story of Uncle Freddy. Uncle Freddy was that family member who would arrive at the family reunion and everything would get very quiet. People would begin to whisper as soon as Uncle Freddy arrived. "He's here," they would say. Slightly off center and never apologetic about it. Two things you should know about Uncle Freddy. One, the only thing he ever carried in his pocket was the almanac. No money, just the almanac. His way, two, he made every decision in his day by referring to the almanac. Also, his way of reminding the entire family that we were not living full lives was to call all of us slaves. You will come to understand that when I read the poem. I wanted to visit him once when I was coming home from college. I called him from a roadside gas station. I said, "Uncle Freddy, I want to come see you." This is what you heard. He said, "No, baby, I don't think it's a good day." I said, "Okay, I'll call you later." Called him later. He said, "Come by." I ran to his house. He took me in the back room, a room nobody ever went in. He pulled an envelope from the top of the closet. He said, "I want you to have something." In it was a term paper, an essay he had written in college. I said, "College? Uncle Freddy, I didn't know you went to college." He said, "Yeah, I tried it once. Didn't stay long." Pulled out the essay. On it, in the right corner, was a big red F. The title of the essay, "One Day When a Man Walks on the Moon." He said, "Daughter, let this be a lesson. When you know something in your heart, and nobody else believes you, hold on to it with two hands." The Black Orion, the star man, was Frederick J. Davenport, 1903 to 1992. In his orbiting eyes, we are all slaves, slavish to things we cannot do without. Slavish to whatever is new and fandangled and polished and pearled. In his cornfield while waiting for grouse to stir, to shoot and freeze for Christmas, he told me, "I am leaving a world of slaves behind. So what am I really leaving?" No wonder you define loneliness by all the things you do not have. A man who did not know that things had ever changed, because he beheld the sky as something that may shift, but was forever dependably exact. A man who did not believe that things should ever change, his only concern was up. His channel was the shifting sky and the always ground. He found scripture in the tissue-thin pages of the almanac. A man who did not want to know the answer to it all, who liked it the old way, just fine. In College Astronomy, 1959, Fred J. Davenport, he wrote a paper. He predicted that in 10 years, more or less, a man would walk on the moon. And would he be a slave to Uncle? Of course he would, he said, if he turned around and came back here. Handing in these dreamy notions to learned men who graded him poorly. "Slaves," he said of them all as he sat before their limited eyes. "Slaves would only see it as illuminated soil. The star man saw it as real and therefore walkable. His prediction missed by only weeks. This blazing, unfettered man who spent his life staring at the sky more than he kept up or eye on any human spheres knew, he always scared me how he knew. Don't you get on the road, girl, until Lyra lines up with Orion. Yes, sir. Barley colored and bespeckled, tin caps and goobers always in his pockets. This, he would say to the goober, is the real money. At night, he would stand before the sky, arms folded and alone, a motionless dragon nostriling the dark, breaking bread at his terrestrial table, and tossing Dr. Carver seeds as he came and went, preaching always about the above, the arrangement of above, and nothing else. His white corn silk hair moving downwind like a cloud of gas and dust. The black Orion who planted taters and melons by the aggregates of lights and darks, by shooting stars, and the Aurora Australis explained to me, that I was a slave. Why? Because I could never stay long enough to see his meteors shower. Because I could never just come and visit him alone there in his pine tree galaxy, teeming with red dust bowls and candle flies. And to his unbuttoned eyes, there it was always too sacred and dark, too perfect and complete for my no-count books. So many times I came up his road, a skinny, empty-handed woman, and left a fat, imaginative girl with too many presents for my arms to carry. It is Sunday, and I call home. I hear Mama say, "He's gone, baby. The star man left the ground today, lifted off without me, gone away. Gone far, just like he said he would." I was in Philadelphia doing a reading to a much smaller crowd on a much colder night. And this woman walked in like everyone had walked in. The only difference between what everybody else had done was that she didn't sit down. And she stood in the back of the room for the rest of the night. When everyone filed out, she walked down to me. And this is what she said. "Hey, you write like a black woman who's never been hit before." The Girlfriend's Train. I read poetry in Philly for the first time ever. She started walking up all the way from in back of the room. From against the wall she came, big coat, boots, eyes soft as candles and two storms blowing. Something she could not see from way back there, but could clearly hear in my voice. Something she needed to know before pouring herself back out into the icy city night. She came close to get a good look, to ask me something she found in a strange way missing from my black woman poetry. Sidestepping the crowd, ignoring the book signing line, she stood there waiting for everyone to go, waiting like some kind of representative. And when it was just the two of us, she stepped into the shoes of her words. "Hey," she said, "you write real soft, spell it out kind, no bullet holes, no open wounds in your words. How do you do that? Write like you've never been hit before." I could hardly speak. All my breath held ransom by her question. I looked at her and imagined there must be a train on pause somewhere, maybe just outside the back door where she had stood listening. A train with boxcars that she was escorting somewhere when she heard about the reading and came in. A train with boxcars carrying broken women's bodies, their carved up legs and bullet-riddled stomachs momentarily on pause from moving cross-country. Women's bodies, brown, black, and blue, laying right where coal, cars, and cattle usually do. She needed my answer for herself and for them too. "Hey," she said, "we were just wondering how you made it through and we didn't." I shook my head. I had never thought about having never been hit and what it might have made me sound like. "You know how many times I've been stabbed?" she asked me. She raised her blouse all the way to her breasts, the cuts on her resembling some kind of grotesque wallpaper. "Tell me, how many women are there like you?" She had been sent in from the Philly cold by the others on the train to listen, to stand up close, to make me out as best she could. She put my hand over top hers, asked, could we stand up, straight back to straight back, measure out our differences right there and then. She gathered it all up, wrote down the things she could, remembering the rest to the train load of us waiting out back for answers, full to the brim with every age of woman, every neighborhood of woman whose name had already been forgotten. Then the train blew its whistle and she started to hurry. I moved towards her and we stood back to back, her hand grazing the top of our heads, my hand measuring out our same widths, each of us recognizing the brown woman latitudes, the black woman longitudes in each other. I turned around and held up my shirt and brought my smooth belly into her scarred one, our navels pressing, marking out some kind of new equatorial lines. I love archival work. I love the surprise that writing always brings to me when I do. I love finding fragments of lines and stories and storing them away in notebooks and not knowing when or how I will use them in my writing. An example of this I talked about earlier today at the masterclass. I love Discover Magazine. It has to do with the scientists living inside of me. I found this quote 10 years before I used it in an article describing what happened to men in foxholes while fighting in World War II. They would get out of the foxholes, and some of them would look down at the fronts of their fighting shirts. Their shirts would be stained with a liquid made somewhere inside their bodies that exited their chests. Here's the quote from Discover Magazine. "Breast development occurs commonly and spontaneous lactation occasionally in men under conditions of starvation." Fast forward 10 years, I was in Toronto. I looked up from my cup of Java, and there across the street was a poem walking by. After writing it, I knew the Discover Magazine line would be my beginning. This is called "Men Who Give Milk." in Toronto, there is a man with Wole Soyinka hair, walking one way, a garbage bag bobbles in his arms. Now and then, he looks another way, behind him, where another bag sits. He does not turn for it, not then. Instead, he pays full attention to his future, walking all the way ahead. Down the street he goes, tipping, a tightrope walker's agility. His bag, as bulbous as a giant's eye, cannot help him see. People with steaming cups and toasted breads push to not be in his way. His whole wide world is on the move. I keep one eye on him and his moving bag. The other eye is kept on the bag of his corner past. He reaches the end of the street, sits the bag in his arms down on the corner, gentles it as if it is a sack of the last time he heard the high yellow and coral orange of his mother's laugh. Before, when his world had a lock, a key, a ceiling, a floor, a proper place for her to cup his lion-eyed face. As he leaves, he pats the bag on its belly, U-turns, walks two blocks back to the other bag, squats, picks that bag up, turns forward again, once again, walking, walking. His walk is strong as if he has children, three, one wife to love until the end, a 30-year mortgage, a niggling boss. Keep your shiny quarters, his feet sing out to the bread pushers. He does not stop at the first corner or the second corner with his first bag. He walks beyond into his future to the third corner where he sits the bag in his arms, the bag of his dreams down. He settles his hand on this bag's spine as if it is that day in the country with his father when it was about to rain. This is how to shift and glide, the old man says. The old four-speed truck lurches like a bullfrog. 2 hours of repeat instruction, and the old man finally reaches for the boy's temple, his hand, an onyx butterfly, landing on a purple bush it both fears and fancies. This is the first time his father has ever touched him. The boy's able parking between two old oaks, laying down the sure, smooth tracks of the man-to-be. The walking man, with hair like Wole Soyinka, stands and turns away from this noonday flash of the ephemeral. He goes back for the sunshine bag that is fat with his laughing mother, who is always reaching, even now, for his browning and walking face. He walks it to the corner, beyond the bag spilling, with his finally satisfied father. This picking up and putting down, this serpentine stepping, goes on until the sun gives up. All day, all week, the pendant, then crescent, then waning whole winter moon pours. With every step, his feet stitch, then unbraid. The woolly strings of his heart keep moving. His two bags never meet on the same corner. Everything now out of his reach is never out of his arms for long. In Toronto, a man zigzags his way across Canada. In Canada, a black man stitches himself back to earth. In 2005, a hurricane hit New Orleans. The question for me as a poet was then and is now, that big old storm, would it change us? The way we look at each other sometimes? The way we see and don't see each other sometimes. the way we care about some people and throw others away. This is a poem called Left, and it has what I call a running epigraph. And the epigraph is this: eeny, meeny, miny, moe. From Rudyard Kipling, a counting out song, in Land and Sea Tales for Scouts and Guides, 1923. The woman with cheerleading legs has been left for dead. She hot paces a roof 4 days, 3 nights, her leaping fingers, her helium arms rise and fall, pulling at the weak old baby in the bassinet, pointing to the 82-year-old grandmother, fanning and raspy in the New Orleans Saints folding chair. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. 3 times a day, the helicopter flies by in a low crawl. The grandmother insists on not being helpless, so she waves a white handkerchief that she puts on and takes off her head toward the cameraman and the pilot, who remembers well the art of his mirrored-eyed posture in his low-flying helicopter. Bong son, dong ha, play ku, chu lai. He makes a slow Viet Cong dip and dive, a move known in rescue as the observation pass. The roof is surrounded by broken levee water. The people are dark, but not broken. Starving, abandoned, dehydrated, brown, and cumulus, but not broken. The 400-year-old anniversary of observation begins again. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, ketcha. The woman with pom-pom legs waves her uneven homemade sign. It says, please help, please. And even if the E has been left off of the please, do you know simply by looking at her that it has been left off because she can't spell and therefore is not worth saving? Or was it because the water was rising so fast, there wasn't time? Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, ketcha. The low-flying helicopter does not know the answer. It catches all of this on patriotic tape, but does not land and does not drop dictionary or ladder. Regulations require an E be at the end of any please before any national response can be taken. Therefore, it takes 4 days before the National Council of Observers will consider dropping one bottle of water or one case of dehydrated baby formula on the roof where the E has rolled off into the flood, where 4 days later, not the mother, not the baby girl, but the determined hanky waver, whom they were both named for, has now been covered up with a green plastic window awning, pushed to the side, right where the missing E was last seen. My mother said to pick the very best one. What else would you call it, Mr. Every Child Left Behind? Anyone you know ever left off or put on an E by mistake? Potato, potato. I tell you, the grandmothers were right about everything. People who outlive bullwhips and Bull Connor, historically afraid of water and routinely fed to crocodiles, left in the sun on the sticky tar heat of roofs to roast like pigs, surrounded by 40 feet of churning water in the summer of 2005, while the richest country in the world played the old observation game. Study the situation. Wondered by committee what to do. Counted in private by long, long historical division, speculated whether or not some people are surely born ready, accustomed to flood, to famine, to fear. My mother said to pick the very best one, and you are not it. After all, it was only Poe New Orleans, old bastard city of funny spellers, non-swimmers, with squeeze box accordion accents. Tell me, who would be alive to care. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. This is my last poem before we get into the part of the evening that I love so much, which is the Q&A. I want to tell you that before I wrote this poem, I was trying to escape poetry. I had been working really hard on some poems, and I thought, I'm just going to go to the movies. I just want to see something that has no poetic inclination or anything. I just want to go sit in the dark. So I go. I go to a matinee. I choose March of the Penguins. Come on, no poetry there. There I am in the theater with four other strange people from other walks of life. We're all minding our own business. I'm eating my popcorn. I'm thinking I shouldn't be eating this popcorn. The father is standing there, half frozen. The little baby penguin is on his feet, half frozen. The mother penguin, who has been like vacationing in Hawaii somewhere and eating all the fish she can eat, arrives back. She smells out her family. She goes up to the little baby penguin, and what does she do? She regurgitates into the little baby penguin's mouth. I scream out in the movie theater, that happened to me once. Penguin, mullet, bread. She pulls white, oily meat of mullet off the long, sharp bones of spine. The bones prick. She never once says, ouch. I watch her long fingers. 7 inches away, my eyes are two glossy olives glued to the delicate woman's mouth. It is summer. Behind her, the white curtains she has made move like seagrass, tall, freckled, waving just beyond. I am camera, but she is movie. She bites, then rolls, placing plump, soft chunks of fish into the side of her mouth. Her eyes grow big from what she tastes. I study her mouth, not her eyes. She chews slowly, never showing me what's there. Her tongue twists and falls. My dinner moves in slow whitefish animation. She coos like a woman who can taste any flavor in the world. A woman who can hula hoop in her own mouth. My hand rises. My fingers reach, fall short, then fall again. I want to say, mama, pull the flesh from the throat. Not the belly. The meat there has more juice than the meat around the fins, but she is the mama. And I have no baby patois, for what little I know of watery things. I have only 17 months of new desire and only two ways of showing it. She chews down on the flesh of the fish, packs it around good until it is a perfect caramel mush. Catching some of the juice that falls with her longest finger there at the corner of her mouth, she pushes all of the sweet flesh back inside. Once or twice, she pulls out a hatpin-sized bone, hiding in the waves of tender meat. Only then does she wear her eureka smile. Holding it up in the air to show me, my wishful eyes rise, my body shifts. My newish eyes lift over and beyond the white curtains that all visitors believe are store-bought. This, she says, is why you have a mama. Her empire backbone finally speaks. This is why you must never talk back to me. This is why you must love, honor, and obey me. My job and her toes, pas de deux, is to feed and tell you the stories and keep you away from sharp things that might slip into your throat and never completely disappear. Her eyes plié into the slinky circles of her mouth, the sweet flesh is finally ground. Salt and snapper, spit and meal are a fine pâté. She reaches her long brown fingers deep inside her jaw, our hinged mouths open, mine prematurely. My fists are flying fleshy verbs in the apple air of her kitchen, balled in sweet anticipation. My chubby legs yoga extend into early orgasmic pose. My chin sets into downward facing dog. My begging eyes and dark mauve lips close in slow around her fingers. The pounded succulent fish and spit lands on the center of my tongue. I swell in my first chair ever, fed by the mother who relishes the story of turning her back and leaving me once to swim off 1,000 miles, find food, fight off shimmering shark, then swim 1,000 miles back just to drop her beak into mine. I am the lucky girl of the high chair.
Thank you very much.
So we'll get started with Q&A.
Sure.
And we take a couple of questions always from the subscribers on Facebook first to get us started. So this question is, what is the most important thing you learned from Tony Cade Bambara?
Great question.
Maybe you could explain who she is, too.
Yes, Tony Cade Bambara, if you don't know, when you leave here tonight, run, find out who she was and who she is and the impact her amazing writing had on this country. Amazing short story writer who was my mentor in my mid-20s. She had a community writing workshop in Atlanta where I was in graduate school. And there were so many gifts that she gave me, but I'm going to tell you two quick stories. I was walking her to the bus stop one day, and this man approached. He looked like he was a bus driver. And there had just been a story about Tony Cade Bambara in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And so the man said, not to me, but to Tony Cade, are you that writer lady? And I thought he was gonna ask for her autograph, of course. That's what people do, you know. She said, yeah, I'm that writer lady. And so he opens up his pocket and he takes out these papers that are folded, beautifully folded. And he said, hey, my wife and I are trying to buy a house, and we don't know what all this means. Can you help us? And I wanted to say, are you crazy? Do you know who this is? And you know what she said? Come by my house 4 o'clock on Saturday. I'll help you. In that moment was stamped upon me what a writer is and who a writer could be to a community. Not just someone who signed autographs, but someone who wrote about the community and also lended a hand and a head when that community needed things that a writer could do. So it was a very important moment in my life. Second thing, 1995, Tony Cade Bambara was dying of cancer in Philadelphia. And I sent her a copy of my second book, Rice, and she sent me a postcard back.
And I still have it right above my writing desk. And it says this: Nikki, do not leave the arena to the fools. I have used that every day of my life since. I pass it on to you now so that you can enter the arena and get some of those, you know what, out of the arena.
I would love to know if anything in Nikki's background or experience particularly led her to poetry.
I could talk about this all night, but the influence that my grandmother, it was a coming together of many things, but one was the influence of my grandmother, who was a farming woman in South Carolina, who probably went as far as the 10th grade or so, but who was the most brilliant woman I ever knew, because she mixed her head knowledge with her belly knowledge. And she never let me forget that. And she did make me tell the truth or else. And I'm really still trying to do that with my work. I'm really trying very hard not to skirt the hard things, but to still say them as beautifully as I know how. Because who needs somebody to rant up on a podium? None of us. But who needs somebody at a podium and a microphone to tell the truth for once? We all do. So I thank my grandmother every day of my life for not letting me off easy in that way, because I see so many people easily lying today like it means nothing.
Are there particular forms of poetry that you enjoy the most?
I write mainly in free verse, but I love taking a form and sort of changing it. I've kind of been doing that my entire life. I love pantoums. I love the meter of a line. But I think more free verse, I'm more attracted to words in poetry and in words and beginning words and things like that. But I do love pantoums. And in this last book, there is something sort of sonnet-esque that I had a lot of fun playing with. And it took over 100 drafts of a poem called Plunder, which is about the last state of the a nation address that George Bush made to this country. Exactly.
Can you tell us more about, and this is in the quotes, making a plan for words?
Making a plan for words. Maybe this is back to the Toni Cade Bambara. I could tell you so many things she taught me, but in the workshop one day, it was my turn to present. And this is, I hope my high school students up there are listening really carefully to this. So I read this poem that I thought was really cool. And she said, everybody was commenting on how cool it was. And she says, hey, Finney, so you write pretty. So what? What's the plan? I thought, plan? Can I just write pretty? No, you have to have a plan. You have to have a plan. And so that was the time in my life when I started thinking beyond the sort of prettiness of language to what language could do and where I wanted it to take me.
So to follow on that question, this is maybe just me zeroing in on something in there. What do you say to those who believe that political poetry is in fact not poetry?
I don't really have to answer that. I mean, you can spend your time in the arena answering ridiculous things, or you can just do your work and know that the history of poetry is
ripe and lush with political ideas. And it's not so much what you write about, but how you write about it that matters so much. And so I don't spend a lot of time with, in my very first book reading, a man stood up in the back and he said, "Young lady, you need to leave all that politics behind or nobody's gonna come and listen to you in the future." I wish he was here tonight. People will tell you a lot of things, but it goes back to Uncle Freddie and that essay he wrote. When you know something in your heart and nobody else believes you or knows it, what do? Toss it away? Hold on to it. And that's what I've done, because all my models in the beginning years were folks who had, you know, one job during the day and then they were activists at night or at the same time. And so I knew you could do it. I just knew there was a way that it had to be done.
Can I ask you one last question?
Yes.
So just because we're a teaching organization and we do a lot of teaching and you do a lot of teaching, can you just talk briefly about the role of teaching in your life in terms of how it impacts your work?
When I first started teaching creative writing and poetry, I was warned, "Be careful. You'll never write again." I said, "Okay, I will be careful." And yet I have found this most honorable art and act has provided so many moments of inspiration and work. Because one of the things that I do when I teach is I do my own assignments. So I have this, you know, if I give a writing assignment in class, my students look up and they see me scribbling along with them. They say, "What are you doing?" I have a poem coming. I'm trying to catch it like you are. And I think that's really, really important to be the instructor in the classroom, but also to be the student in the classroom. And one of the reasons I love to visit classrooms of all kind is because I'm a curious soul, and I'm always ready to learn something else about the act of writing, the art of poetry, and then how to come before you on a night like this and communicate what I feel and what I have learned back to you, and hope that you then take it and communicate it to somebody else so that the arena is never full of the you-know-whos.
That was Nikki Finney from a 2013 Portland Arts and Lectures event. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Hahn, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More on colehahn.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.